for his pistol and told Kitty to call 911. In the frenzy that followed, he ran into the dark hallway and saw two shadows rising quickly from the stairwell. Voices were coming from downstairs. He hit the floor and began firing. He was immediately hit in the shoulder. "No," he said emphatically. "No one ever yelled out anything about the police." Kitty screamed and ran into the hallway and into a volley of bullets. Doug breaks down when he describes the sounds of his wife being hit. Half of the jurors are crying too. Chapter 25. Finney wants no part of Doug Renfro. He attempts to prove that Doug deliberately fired upon the police, but Doug crushes him by saying over and over, "I didn't know they were cops. I thought they were criminals breaking into my house. I call no other witnesses. I don't need them." Finney walks through a half-hearted closing argument, during which he refuses to make eye contact with any of the jurors. When it's my turn, I recap the important facts and manage to control myself. It would be easy to flay the cops, to engage in unbridled overkill. But the jury has had enough. Judge Ponder instructs the jurors as to the applicable law, then says it's time for them to retire and deliberate. But no one moves. What happens next borders on historic. Juror number 6 is a man named Willie Grant. Slowly he stands and says,
"Judge, I've been elected as the foreman of this jury, and I have a question."
The judge, a jurist of great composure, is startled and looks wildly at Finney and me. The courtroom is again perfectly silent. Me, I'm not breathing. His Honor says,
"Well, I'm not sure at this point. I have instructed the jury to retire and begin deliberations."
The jurors have not moved. Mr. Grant says,
"We don't need to deliberate, Your Honor. We know what we're going to do."
"But I have repeatedly warned you against discussing the case," Ponder says sternly. Unfazed, Mr. Grant replies,
"We haven't discussed the case, but we have a verdict. There's nothing to discuss or deliberate. My question is, why is Mr. Renfro on trial and not the cops who killed his wife?"
There is an instant wave of gasping and chattering throughout the courtroom. Judge Ponder attempts to regain control by clearing his throat loudly and asking,
"Is your verdict unanimous?"
"Damned right it is. We find Mr. Renfro not guilty, and we think these cops should be charged with murder."
"I'm going to ask the jurors to raise your hands if you agree with the not guilty verdict."
12 hands shoot into the air. I put my arm around Doug Renfro as he breaks down again. Part 4. The Exchange. Chapter 1. I often disappear after a big trial, especially one that gets front-page coverage and plenty of airtime. It's not that I don't love the attention. I'm a lawyer. It's in my genes. But in the Renfro trial, I humiliated the police department, embarrassed some cops, some really tough guys who were not accustomed to answering for their misdeeds. As they say, the streets are hot right now, and it's time for a break. I load some clothes into the van along with my golf clubs, some paperbacks, and half a case of small-batch bourbon, and ease out of town the day after the verdict. The weather is raw and windy, too cold for golf, so I head south like countless other snowbirds in search of the sun. I have learned through my meandering travels that almost every small town with a population above 10,000 has a public golf course. These are usually packed on weekends, but not too crowded during the week. I play my way south, hitting at least one course per day, sometimes two, playing alone with no caddy and no scorecard, paying cash for inexpensive motel rooms, eating little, and sipping bourbon late at night while I read the latest James Lee Burke or Michael Connelly. If I had a pile of money, I could spend the rest of my life doing this. But I don't, so I eventually return to the city, where my notoriety instantly catches up to me. Chapter 2. About a year ago, a young woman named Gillianna Kemp was abducted as she was leaving a hospital after visiting a friend. Her car was found untouched on the third floor of a parking garage next to the hospital. Surveillance cameras caught her walking toward her car, but lost her as she stepped out of range. The footage from all 14 cameras was analyzed. It captured the license plates of every vehicle coming and going for a 24-hour period, and revealed only one significant clue. An hour after Gillianna was seen walking to her car, a blue Ford SUV left the parking deck. The driver was a white male wearing a baseball cap and glasses. The SUV had stolen license plates from Iowa. During the night, the attendants saw nothing suspicious, and the one who took the ticket from the white male did not remember him. 40 vehicles had passed through the exit gate in the hour preceding the SUV's departure. Detectives scoured every inch of the garage and found nothing. Her abductor made no demand for ransom. The search went from frantic to futile. An initial reward of $100,000 provoked no response. 2 weeks later, the blue SUV was found abandoned in a state park 100 miles away. It had been stolen a month earlier in Texas. Its license plates were from Pennsylvania. Stolen, of course. The abductor was playing games. He had wiped the SUV clean. No prints, no hairs, no blood, nothing. His range, along with his planning, terrified the investigators. They were not chasing an ordinary criminal. Adding to the urgency was the fact that Gillianna Kemp's father is one of the city's two assistant chiefs of police. Needless to say, the case was given the highest priority by the department. What was not made public at the time was that Gillianna was 3 months pregnant. As soon as she disappeared, her live-in boyfriend told her parents about the pregnancy. They kept this quiet as the police worked around the clock to find her. Gillianna has not been heard from. Her body has not been found. She's probably dead. But when was she murdered? The worst possible scenario is also the most obvious. She wasn't killed immediately, but was held captive until after she gave birth. 9 months after her disappearance, as the reward money continued to pile up, a tip led the police to a pawn shop not far from my apartment building. A gold necklace with a small Greek coin had been pawned for $200. Gillianna's boyfriend identified the necklace as the one he'd given her the previous Christmas. In a full-court press, detectives worked furiously to establish a chain of possession. It led to another pawn shop, to another transaction, and finally to a suspect named Arch Swanger. A 31-year-old drifter with no apparent means of support, Swanger had a history of petty thievery and small-time drug dealing. He lived in a rundown trailer park with his mother, who was a drunk drawing disability checks. After a month of intense surveillance and scrutiny, Swanger was finally brought in for questioning. He was evasive and coy, and after 2 hours of fruitless interrogation, clammed up and demanded a lawyer. With little hard evidence, the police let him go, but continued to monitor his every movement. Still, he managed to slip away several times, but always returned home. Last week, they picked him up again for questioning. He demanded a lawyer. "Okay, who's your lawyer?" the detective asked.
"That guy named Rudd. Sebastian Rudd."
Chapter 3. The last thing I need is more trouble with the police. But as we say in the trade, we don't always get to choose our clients. And every defendant, regardless of how despicable the person or his crime, is entitled to a lawyer. Most laymen don't understand this and don't care. I don't care either. This is my job. To be honest, I'm initially thrilled Swanger picked me, thrilled to be allowed to stick my nose smack in the middle of another sensational case. This one, though, will haunt me forever. I'll curse the day I hustled over to Central to have my first chat with Arch Swanger. The police department has more leaks than old plumbing, and by the time I arrive at Central, word is out. A reporter with a cameraman catches me as I enter the building and demands to know if I represent Arch Swanger. I offer a rude, "No comment," and keep walking. From that moment on, though, everyone in town knows I'm his lawyer. It's a perfect fit, right? A monstrous murderer and the rogue lawyer who'll defend anyone. I've strolled through Central many times, and the place is always bustling with an urgent energy. Street cops in uniforms rush around, bantering crudely with those stuck behind desks. Detectives in cheap suits swagger through the halls, scowling as if they're pissed at the world. Frightened families sit on benches waiting for bad news. And there's always a lawyer huddled up with a cop in a tense negotiation, or hurrying to get to a client before he spills his guts. Today the air is especially heavy, the mood tense. I get more stares than usual when I walk through the front door. And why not? They've caught the killer. He's just down the hall. And here comes his lawyer to save him. Both should be grabbed and put on the rack. Present, too, is the lingering rawness of the Renfro trial. It was only 3 weeks ago, and cops have long memories. Some of these guys would like to take a nightstick and break a few of my bones, or worse. They lead me through the maze to the interrogation rooms. Down the hall, smoking and looking into a one-way mirror, are two homicide detectives. One is Landy Reardon, the cop who called me with the news that, out of all the lawyers in the city, I had been chosen. Reardon is the best homicide detective in the department. He's nearing retirement now, and the years have taken their toll. He's about 60, but looks 10 years older, with thick white hair that goes untouched for the most part. He still smokes and has the jagged wrinkles as proof. He sees me and nods. "Come on over." The other detective disappears. The good thing about Landy Reardon is that he is brutally honest and will not waste time on a case he can't prove. He digs hard for the evidence, but if it's not there, then it's not there. In 30 years, he's never charged the wrong murder suspect. But if Landy collars you for murder, the judge and jury will fall in line and you'll probably die in prison. He's had the Juliana Kemp case since the beginning. 4 months ago, he had a mild heart attack and his doctor told him to retire. He found another doctor. I stand beside him and both of us look through the mirror. We do not say hello. He thinks all defense lawyers are scum and would never stoop to shake my hand. Swanger is alone in the interrogation room. He's kicked back in his folding chair and has his feet on the table, totally bored with everything. "What's he said?" I ask.
"Nothing. Name, rank, and serial number. And after that, he called for you. Said he saw your name in the newspaper."
"So he can read?"
"IQ of 130, I'd guess. He just looks stupid."
Indeed, he does. Plump with a double chin, large brown freckles from the neck up, head practically shaved but for a few waxed bristles, like the old butch crew cut from 60 years ago, pre-Beatles. To attract either attention or ridicule, he is wearing a pair of round-frame glasses, absurdly large and aqua blue in color. "About those glasses," I say.
"Drugstore, cheap and fake. He doesn't need glasses, but he fancies himself clever when it comes to disguises. Actually, he's pretty good. He slipped our surveillance a few times in the past month, but always comes home."
"What do you have on him?" Landy exhales in fatigue and frustration.
"Not much," he says.
And I admire the guy's honesty. He's a brilliant cop and knows better than to level with me. But he inspires confidence.
"Enough for an indictment?" "I wish. We're not even close to an arrest. Chief wants to hold him for a week or two. Crank up the pressure, you know, see if the guy'll break. But really, to see if lightning will strike and we get lucky. Fat chance. We'll probably let him go again. Between me and you, Rudd, we ain't got much."
"Seems like you have plenty of suspicion." Landy grunts and laughs.
"We're good at that. Look at him. Talk about suspicious.
I'd give him 10 years in solitary just based on the first impression.
Maybe 5, I say.
Talk to him, and if you want, I'll show you the file tomorrow.
Okay, I'm going in, but I've never met this guy, and I'm not sure I'll be his lawyer. There's always the issue of getting paid, and he doesn't look too prosperous. If he's indigent, PD takes over, and I'm out of the picture.
Have fun.
Chapter 4 Swanger takes his feet off the desk, stands, and we make our introductions. Firm handshake, eye contact, easy voice with no trace of concern. Playing it cool, I restrain myself from telling him to take off those damned glasses. If he likes them, then I'm crazy about him.
I saw you on TV, he says. That cage fighter that killed the ref. Whatever happened to him?
The case is still pending, waiting for a trial. You go to cage fights?
No. I watch him on TV with my mum. I thought about getting into it a few years back.
I almost laugh. Even if he dropped 30 pounds and trained 8 hours a day, this guy wouldn't last 10 seconds in a cage. He'd probably faint in the dressing room. I sit at the table empty-handed and ask,
Now, what did you want to talk about?
That girl, man. You know the case. These guys think I'm involved in some way and they're hassling me. They've been on my ass for months now, always hiding in the shadows as if I don't know what's going on. This is the second time they've hauled me in here like something on television. You watch Law and Order? Well, these guys have watched way too much, and they're really bad actors, know what I mean? That old one with the white hair, Reardon, I think? He's the good guy, always just looking for the truth and trying to find ways to help me. Right. Then the skinny one, Barkley, he'll come in and start yelling. Back and forth. Good cop, bad cop. Like I don't know the game. Ain't my first rodeo, pal.
Your first murder charge, right?
Hang on, Superman. I ain't been charged yet.
Okay. Assuming you are charged with murder. I take it you want me to represent you.
Well, gee. Why else would I call you, Mr. Rudd? I'm not sure I need a lawyer right now, but it damned sure feels like it.
Understood. Are you employed?
Here and there. How much do you charge for a murder case?
Depends on how much a person can pay. A case like this, I'll need $10,000 up front, and that'll just get us through the indictment phase. Once we're looking at a trial, then we get to the serious fee. If we can't agree, then you go elsewhere.
Where's elsewhere?
Public Defender's Office. They handle virtually all murders.
Figures. But what you're not factoring in here, Mr. Rudd, is all the publicity. Ain't too many cases as big as this one. Pretty girl, important family, and that thing with the baby. If she had a kid, then where is it, right? That'll drive the press crazy. So you gotta figure that this thing is front page news, starting right about now. I've seen you on television. I know how much you love to bark and growl and strut in front of the cameras. This case will be a gold mine for my defense lawyer. Don't you agree, Mr. Rudd?
He's hammering the nail on the head, but I can't admit this. I say, I don't work for free, Mr. Swanger, regardless of the publicity. I have too many other clients.
Of course you do. Big lawyer like you. I didn't call no rookie in here to save my ass. They're talking death penalty, man, and they mean it. I'll get the money one way or the other. The question is, will you take my case?
Usually, by this point in the first meeting, the accused has already denied the charges. I make a mental note that Swanger has not done so, has not ventured anywhere near the issue of his guilt or innocence. In fact, he seems to be welcoming an indictment, with a big trial to follow. I say, Yes, I'll represent you, assuming we can come to terms on the money and assuming they actually indict you. I think they have a ways to go. In the meantime, don't say a word to the cops, any cop. Understood?
Got it, man. Can you get them to back off, stop the harassment?
I'll see what I can do. We shake hands again and I leave the room.
Detective Reardon has not moved. He's watched our little meeting, and he's probably listened to it, too, though that would be illegal. Standing next to him, in casual clothes, is Roy Kemp, father of the missing girl. He glares at me with unbridled hatred, as if the few minutes I just spent with their first and rather weak suspect is clear proof that I'm involved in his daughter's disappearance. I have sympathy for the man and his family, but right now he wants to put a bullet in the back of my head. Outside the building, more reporters have gathered. When they see me, they start hopping and shoving. I brush by them with, "No comment, no comment, no comment," as they lob their idiotic questions. One actually yells, "Mr. Rudd, did your client abduct Gillianna Kemp?" I want to stop, walk over to this clown, and ask him if he might possibly come up with a dumber question. But instead, I push by them and hop in the van with partner. Chapter 5. At 6 o'clock, the anchormen scream the news that the police have a suspect in the Kemp case. They show footage of Arch Swanger being mobbed by reporters as he tries to leave Central not long after I did. According to sources, unnamed of course, but undoubtedly from within the building, he's been interrogated by the police and will soon be arrested and charged with kidnapping and murder. To prove his guilt, he's hired Sebastian Rudd to defend him. They show me scowling at the cameras. Finally, the city can breathe easier. The police have the killer. To relieve the enormous pressure on them and to begin the process of poisoning public opinion and to establish the presumption of guilt, they are manipulating the press, as always. A leak here and there, and cameras show up to capture the face that everyone has been desperate to see. The journalists chase their tails, and Arch Swanger is as good as convicted. Why bother with a trial? If the cops can't convict with evidence, they use the media to convict with suspicion. Chapter 6. I spend a lot of time in a building officially and affectionately known as the Old Courthouse. It's a grand old structure, built around the turn of the century, with soaring Gothic columns and high ceilings, wide marble hallways lined with busts and portraits of dead judges, winding staircases, and four levels of courtrooms and offices. It's usually crawling with people, lawyers doing their business, litigants searching for the right courtroom, families of criminal defendants wandering fearfully about, potential jurors clutching their summonses, and cops waiting to testify. There are 5,000 lawyers in this city, and at times it seems as though every one of us is hustling around the old courthouse. As I leave a hearing one morning, a man who looks vaguely familiar falls in beside me and says, "Hey, Rudd, got a minute?" I don't like his looks, his tone, or his rudeness. What about Mr. Rudd, to start with? I keep walking. So does he. "Have we met?" I ask.
"It doesn't matter. We have something to discuss."
I glance at him as we walk. Bad suit, maroon shirt, hideous tie. A couple of small scars on his face, the kind left behind by fists and beer bottles. "Oh, really?" I say, as rudely as possible.
"Need to talk about Link."
My brain tells me to keep walking, but my feet simply stop moving. My stomach does a long, nauseous flip as my heart races away. I stare at the thug and say, "Well, well, where is Link these days?" It's been 2 months since his dramatic escape from death row, and I haven't heard a word. Not that I would. However, I'm not completely surprised. Frightened, maybe, but not shocked. We move to the edge of the hallway for privacy. The thug says his name is Fango, and there's a 10% chance Fango is the name on his birth certificate. In a corner, with my back to the wall so I can observe the foot traffic, we converse in voices that are low, our lips barely moving. Fango says,
"Link's having a hard time of it, you know. Money's tight, real tight, because the cops are watching everybody even remotely connected to the businesses. They watch his son, his people, me, everybody. If I bought a plane ticket today for Miami, the cops would know about it. Suffocating, you know what I mean?"
Not really, but I just nod. He goes on.
Anyway, Link figures you owe him some money. He paid you a pile, got nothing in return. You really screwed him, you know. And now Link wants a refund.
I fake a laugh like this is just the funniest thing. And it is laughable. A client who loses wants his money back when the case is over. Fango, though, is not in a humorous mood. That's funny, I say. And how much of a refund?
All of it. $100,000. Cash.
I see. So all of the work I did was really for free. Is that it, Fango?
Link would say that all of your work really sucked. Got him nowhere. He hired you because you're a hotshot gunslinger who was supposed to reverse his conviction and get him off. Didn't happen, of course. In fact, he got slammed every which way. He thinks you did a lousy job. Thus, the refund.
Link got slammed because he killed a judge. Oddly enough, when this happens, and it's quite rare, it really pisses off the other judges. I explained all this to Link before he hired me. I even put it in writing. I told him his case would be very difficult to win because of the overwhelming proof the state had. Sure, he paid me in cash, but I put it on the books and sent Uncle Sam about a third of it. The rest of it was spent a long time ago. So there's nothing left for Link. Sorry. Partner approaches, and I give him the nod. Fango sees him, recognizes him, says,
"You got one pit bull, Rudd. Link still has a few more. You got 30 days to get the money together. I'll be back."
He turns and deliberately brushes by Partner as he leaves. Partner could break his neck, but I gesture for him to be cool. No sense starting a fistfight in the middle of the old courthouse, though I've seen several here. Most involved angry lawyers taking swings at each other. Chapter 7. Not long after Tadeo got famous for killing a referee, I began receiving solicitations from doctors claiming to be expert witnesses, all wanting a part in the show. There were a total of 4, all with medical degrees and impressive resumes, all with experience in courtrooms in front of juries. They had read about the case, seen the video, and, to varying degrees, all offered the same opinion. To wit, Tadeo was legally insane when he attacked Sean King in the ring. He did not understand right from wrong, nor did he appreciate the nature of what he was doing. Insanity is a legal term, not a medical one. I talked to all 4, did some research, called other lawyers who'd used them, and settled upon a guy named Dr. Tazelman out of San Francisco. For $20,000 plus expenses, he is willing to testify on Tadeo's behalf and work his magic with the jury. Though he has yet to meet the defendant, he's already convinced he knows the truth. The truth can be expensive, especially when it comes from expert witnesses. Our system is chock full of experts who do little in the way of teaching, researching, or writing. Instead, they roam the country as hired guns, testifying for fat fees. Pick an issue, a set of facts, a mysterious cause, an unexplained result, anything, really, and you can find a truckload of PhDs willing to testify with all sorts of wild theories. They advertise. They solicit. They chase cases. They hang around conventions where lawyers gather to drink and compare notes. They brag about their verdicts. Their losses are rarely mentioned. They are occasionally discredited by nasty cross-examinations in open court, but they stay in business because they are so often effective. In a criminal trial, an expert has to convince only one juror to hang things up and cause a mistrial. Hang it again on the retrial, and the state will usually throw in the towel. I meet Tadeo in a visiting room at the jail, our usual spot, and discuss Dr. Tazelman's possible role in his defense. The expert will testify that he, Tadeo, blacked out, went crazy, and has no recollection of what happened. Tadeo likes this new theory. Yes, come to think of it, he really was insane. I mentioned the fee, and he says he's broke. I've already mentioned my fee, and he was even broker. Needless to say, I'll represent Tadeo Zapata simply because I love him. That and the publicity.
It's the O.J. Simpson theory of legal fees. I'm not paying you. You're lucky to be here. Go make a buck with your book. Using Harry and Harry's paperwork, I file the proper notice telling the court that we will be relying on an insanity defense. Mr. Ace Prosecutor, Max Mancini, howls in response, as always. Max is fully in control of the Zapata matter, primarily because of the overwhelming proof of guilt, as well as the publicity. He's still offering 15 years for second-degree murder. I'm stuck on 10, though I'm not sure my client would plead to that. As the weeks have passed and Taddeo has become the beneficiary of hours of free jailhouse legal advice, he has become even more rigid in his belief that I can somehow pull the right strings and walk him out. He wants one of those technicalities all of his cellmates know about. Dr. Tazelman comes to town and we have lunch. He's a retired psychiatrist who never liked to teach or listen to patients. Legal insanity has always fascinated him, the crime of passion, the irresistible impulse, the moment when the mind is so filled with emotion and hate that it commands the body to act violently and in a way never contemplated. He prefers to do all the talking. It's his way of convincing me how brilliant he is. I listen to his bullshit as I try to analyze how a jury will react to him. He's likable, intense, smart, and a good conversationalist. Plus, he's from California, 2,000 miles away. All trial lawyers know that the greater the distance an expert travels, the more credibility he has with the jury. I write him a check for half of his fee. The other half will be due at trial. He spends 2 hours evaluating Taddeo, and surprise, surprise, he is now certain the kid blacked out, went crazy, and does not remember pummeling the referee. So we now have a defense, shaky as it is. I'm not that encouraged because the state will haul in 2 or 3 experts, all at least as credible as Tazelman, and they will overwhelm us with their brilliance. Taddeo will testify and do a credible job on direct, perhaps even manage some tears. Then he'll get chewed up by Mancini on cross-examination. But the video doesn't lie. I'm still convinced the jurors will watch it over and over and see the truth. They will silently scoff at Tazelman and laugh at Taddeo, and they will return a verdict of guilty. Guilty means 20 to 30 years. On the day of the trial, I'll probably get the prosecutor down to 12 to 15 years. How can I convince a headstrong 22-year-old to plead guilty to 15 years? Scare him with 30? I doubt it. The great Taddeo Zapata has never scared easily. Chapter 8. Today is Starcher's 8th birthday. The battered and abused court order that dictates the time I spend with my son clearly says that I get 2 hours with him on each of his birthdays. 2 hours is too much, according to his mother. She thinks 1 hour is plenty. Actually, no time would be her preference. Shoving me out of his life completely is her goal, but I won't let that happen. I may be a pathetic father, but I am trying. And there might come a day when the kid wants to spend time with me in order to get away from his quarreling mothers. So I'm sitting at a McDonald's, waiting to begin my 2 hours. Judith eventually pulls up in her Jaguar, her lawyer car, and gets out with Starcher. She marches him inside, sees me, scowls as if she'd rather be anywhere else, and hands him over.
"I'll be back at 5 o'clock," she hisses at me.
"It's already 4:15, I say, but she doesn't acknowledge me. She huffs away, and he takes a seat opposite me. I smile and say, "How's it going, bud?"
"Okay," he mumbles, almost afraid to speak to his father.
I cannot imagine the strict orders she hit him with during the drive over. Do not eat the food. Do not drink the drinks. Do not play on the playground. Wash your hands. Do not answer questions if he quizzes you about me or Ava or anything to do with our home. Do not have a good time. It usually takes him a few minutes to shake off this drubbing before he can relax around me. "Happy birthday," I say.
"Thanks."
Mom tells me you're having a big party on Saturday. Lots of kids and cake and stuff like that.
Should be fun.
I guess, he says.
I wasn't invited to the party, of course. It's at his home, the place where he lives half his life with Judith and Ava. A place I've never seen. Are you hungry? He looks around. It's a McDonald's, a kid's paradise, where everything is carefully designed to make people crave the food that looks far more delicious on the walls than on the tables. He zeroes in on a large poster hawking a new ice cream float called the McGlacier.
Looks pretty good. I say, I think I'll try one of those.
You?
Mom says I shouldn't eat anything here. Says it's all bad for me.
This is my time, not Judith's. I smile and lean forward as if we're now conspirators.
But Mom's not here, right?
I won't tell. You won't tell. Just us boys, okay?
He grins and says, okay.
From under the table, I pull out a box that's covered in birthday wrapping and place it on the table.
This is for you, bud. Happy birthday.
Go ahead and open it.
He grabs it as I head toward the counter.
When I return with the floats, he's staring at a small backgammon board on the table. When I was a boy, my grandfather taught me to play checkers, then backgammon, then chess. I was fascinated with board games of all varieties. As a kid, I received board games for birthdays and Christmas. By the time I was 10, I had stacks of them in my room, a vast collection that I took meticulous care of. I seldom lost at any of the games. My favorite became backgammon, and I would pester my grandfather, my mother, my friends, anyone, really, to play. When I was 12, I came in third place in a city tournament for kids. When I was 18, I was competing well in adult tournaments. In college, I played for money until the other students stopped gambling with me. I'm hoping some of this might rub off on my son. It's becoming apparent that he will almost certainly look like me, walk like me, and talk like me. He's very bright, though I must admit he gets a lot of that from his mother. Judith and Ava are keeping him away from video games. After the Renfro trial, I am thrilled by this.
What's this? He asks, taking his McGlacier and looking at the board.
It's called backgammon, a board game that's been around for centuries. I'm going to teach you how to play.
Looks hard, he says, as he takes a spoonful.
It's not. I started playing it when I was 8 years old. You'll catch on.
All right, he says, ready for the challenge.
I arrange the checkers and start with the basics. Chapter 9. Partner parks our van in a crowded lot and walks into the mall. He'll enter a two-story restaurant that anchors one wing of the mall, and he'll find a window seat in a small bar area on the upper level. From there, he'll watch the van to see who else is watching the van. At 4 p.m., Arch Swanger knocks on the sliding door. I open it. Welcome to my office. He takes a seat in a comfortable recliner and looks around. He smiles at the leather, the television, the stereo, the sofa, the refrigerator.
Pretty cool, he says. Is this really your office?
It is.
I figured a big shot like you would have a fancy office in one of those tall buildings downtown.
I had one once, but it got firebombed. Now I prefer a moving target. He stares at me for a second as if he's not sure I'm serious. The goofy blue glasses have been replaced by black readers that actually succeed in making him appear somewhat more intelligent. He's wearing a black felt driving cap that looks authentic. It's a nice look, an effective disguise. From 10 feet away, you wouldn't know it was the same guy. He says,
Really? Your office was firebombed?
It was, about 5 years ago. Don't ask who, because I don't know. It was either a drug dealer or some undercover cops. Personally, I think it was the narcs, because the police showed little enthusiasm when it came to investigating the fire.
You see, that's what I like about you, Mr. Rudd. Can I call you Sebastian?
I prefer Mr. Rudd until I'm hired. After that,
You can call me Sebastian.
Okay, Mr. Rudd. I like it that the cops don't like you, and you don't like them.
I know a lot of the guys on the force, and we get along fine, I say, fudging just a little. I like Nate Spurio and a couple of others. Let's talk business. I've had a chat with a detective, our pal Landy Reardon, and they don't have much in the way of evidence. They're pretty sure you're the guy. They just can't prove it yet. This would be the perfect time for him to deny his guilt. Something simple and thoroughly unoriginal, like, "They got the wrong guy," would be appropriate. Instead, he says,
"I've had lawyers before, several of them, most appointed by the court, and I never felt like I could trust them, you know? But I feel like I can trust you, Mr. Rudd."
Back to the deal, Arch. For a fee of $10,000, I'll represent you through the indictment stage. Once you're indicted and facing a trial, my representation will end. At that point, we'll sit down to discuss our future together.
I don't have $10,000, and I think that's too much just to get to the indictment. I know how the system works.
He's not completely wrong about this. $10,000 for the initial skirmishes is a bit steep, but I always start on the high side. I'm not going to negotiate, Arch. I'm a busy lawyer with a lot of clients. From his shirt pocket, he pulls out a folded check.
Here's $5,000 from my mother's account. It's the best we can do.
I unfold the check. Local bank. $5,000. Signed by Louise Powell.
He says, "Powell was her third husband. Dead. My parents divorced when I was a kid. Haven't seen my dear old dad in a long time."
$5,000 keeps me in the game and in the news, and it's not a bad fee for the first round or two. I refold the check, stick it in my shirt pocket, and pull out a contract for legal services. My cell phone is sitting on the small table in front of me. It vibrates. Partner's calling. "Excuse me a second, I gotta take this."
"It's your office."
Partner says, "You got two cops in a white Jeep 50 feet away, just pulled in and watching the van."
"Thanks. Keep me posted."
I tell Swanger, "Your buddies picked up your tail. They know you're here, and they know my van. Nothing wrong with a lawyer meeting with his client." He shakes his head and says,
"They follow me everywhere. You gotta help me."
I slowly walk him through the contract. When everything is clear, both of us sign it. For good measure, I say, "I'm going straight to the bank. If the check doesn't clear, the contract is void. Understand?"
"You think I'd write a bad check?"
I can't help but smile. I reply,
"Your mother wrote it. I don't take chances." "She drinks too much, but she's not a crook."
"I'm sorry, Arch. I didn't mean to imply that. It's just that I see my share of bad checks." He waves me off and says,
"Whatever."
We stare at the table for a minute or so, and I finally say, "Is there something you'd like to talk about, now that you have a lawyer?"
"You got a beer in that cute little fridge?"
I reach over, open the door, and pull out a can of beer. He pops the top and takes a long swig. He likes it, says with a laugh,
"I guess this is the most expensive beer I've ever had."
That's one way of looking at it. Keep in mind that no other lawyer would serve you a drink in his office.
"Got that right. You're the first."
Another gulp.
"So, Sebastian, it is Sebastian now, right? Now that I've forked over the fee and we've signed a contract?"
"Sebastian works."
"Okay, Sebastian, in addition to some beer, what do I get for $5,000?
"Legal advice for starters. And protection. The cops won't be tempted to drag you in and rough you up in one of their infamous 10-hour interrogations. It'll be hands-off as they play it by the book. I have a relationship with Detective Reardon, and I'll try to convince him that they don't have enough evidence to move forward. If they find any evidence, chances are I'll know about it." He turns the can up, drains it, wipes his mouth with a sleeve. A thirsty frat boy could not have finished the beer any faster. It's another perfect moment for him to say something like,
"There is no evidence."
Instead, he belches and says,
"And if I'm arrested?"
Then I'll be at the jail trying to get you out, which will be impossible. A charge of murder in this city means no bail. I'll file a bunch of motions and make some noise. I have friends at the newspaper, and I'll leak the fact that the police have little in the way of evidence. I'll start intimidating the prosecutor.
Doesn't sound like much for $5,000. Can I have another beer?
I hesitate for a second and quickly decide that 2 will be his limit, at least in my office. I hand him another can and say, I'll refund the money right now, Arch, if you're unhappy with our arrangement. As I've said, I'm a busy lawyer with a lot of clients. $5,000 is not going to change my life. He pops the top and takes a reasonable sip. I ask, you want the check back?
No.
Then stop bitching about the fee. He glares at me, and for the first time, I catch the cold, hollow stare of a killer. I've seen it before. He says,
they're gonna kill me, Sebastian. The cops can't prove anything. They can't find their man, and they're under a ton of pressure. They're afraid of me, because if they arrest me, then they may have to deal with you, and since they have no evidence, they don't want to go to trial. Imagine a not guilty verdict after a huge trial. So, to sort of short-circuit everything, they're just gonna take me out and save everyone the trouble. I know this because they've told me. Not Detective Reardon, not the big shots down at Central, but the cops on the street. Some of those guys who follow me non-stop, 24/7. They even watch the trailer when I'm asleep. They harass me, cuss me, threaten me. And I know they're gonna kill me, Sebastian. You know how rotten this department really is.
He goes silent as he takes another drink. I doubt that, I say. Sure, we have some bad apples, but I've never known them to rub out a murder suspect just because they couldn't nail him.
I know a guy they killed, a drug dealer. Made it look like a botched delivery.
I'm not going to argue about this.
Here's the problem, Sebastian. If they put a bullet in my head, then they'll never find that girl's body.
My stomach flips, but I remain stone-faced. It's customary for the accused to deny guilt. It's unheard of for him to admit to the crime, especially at such an early stage. I never ask criminal defendants if they're guilty. It's a waste of time, and they lie anyway. I proceed carefully with, so you know where her body is?
Let me get this straight, Sebastian. You're now my lawyer, and I can tell you anything, right? If I killed 10 girls and hid their bodies and told you all about it, you couldn't repeat a word, right?
That's right.
Never?
There's only one exception to the rule. If you tell me something in confidence, and I believe that it will endanger other people, then I am allowed to repeat it to the authorities. Other than that, I can never tell. Satisfied, he smiles and takes a drink.
Relax. I didn't kill 10 girls. And I'm not saying I killed Jillianna Kemp either. But I know where she's buried.
Do you know who killed her? He pauses, says yes, then goes silent again. It's obvious he's not naming names. I reach into the fridge and get a beer for myself. We drink for a few minutes. He watches every move as if he knows my heart is pounding away. Finally, I say, okay, I'm not asking for any information, but do you think it's important for someone, maybe me, to know where she is?
Yes, but I have to think about it. Maybe I'll tell you tomorrow. Maybe not.
My thoughts turn directly to the Kemp family and their unspeakable nightmare. At this moment, I hate this guy and would love to see him locked up, or worse. Sipping a beer in my van like he's Joe Cool while the family suffers. When was she killed? I asked, pushing it.
I'm not sure. I didn't do it, I swear. But she did not give birth in captivity, if that's what you want to know. There was no baby sold on the black market.
You know a lot, don't you?
I know too much, and it's about to get me killed. I may have to disappear, you know?
Taking flight is a clear sign of guilt. It will be used against you in court. I wouldn't advise it.
So you want me to stay here and take a bullet?
The cops do not kill murder suspects, okay, Arch? Trust me on this. He crushes his can and leaves it on the table.
I got nothing else to say right now, Sebastian. I'll see you later.
You have my number. He opens the door and gets out. Partner watches him as he glances around, looks for the cops, then enters the mall and disappears. Partner and I drive straight to the bank. The check is no good. I call Arch for an hour and finally get him. He apologizes and promises the check will be good tomorrow. Something tells me I'd be a fool to believe him. Chapter 10. It's 4:33 in the morning and my phone is ringing. I grab it and don't recognize the number. This is always trouble. Hello, I say.
Hey, Sebastian, it's me, Arch. Got a minute?
Of course, Arch. Oddly enough, I'm not that busy in the middle of the night. I take a deep breath and say, Sure, Arch, I have a minute, but it's 4 in the morning, so this better be good.
I'm out of town, okay? Officially on the run. I shook them off and slipped through their net, and I'm not coming back, so they'll never catch me.
Big mistake, Arch. Better find yourself a new lawyer.
You're my lawyer, Sebastian.
The check is rubber, Arch. Remember what I said?
You still have it. Run it through today. I swear it'll clear.
His words are fast and clipped, and he sounds as though he'd been running.
Look, Sebastian, I want you to know where that girl is, okay? Just in case something happens to me. There are others involved, and I could easily end up on the short end of the stick. Know what I mean?
Not really.
I can't explain all of it, Sebastian. It's complicated. I got folks after me, cops as well as some guys who make cops look like Cub Scouts.
Too bad, Arch. I can't help you.
You ever see that billboard down the interstate, about an hour south of here? Big bright sign in a cornfield says, Vasectomy Reversals. You ever see it, Sebastian?
I don't think so. Every reasonable thought and instinct tells me to cancel this call immediately. Just hang up, stupid. And never speak to him again. Physically, though, I freeze and cannot do it. His voice is animated now, as if he's thoroughly enjoying this.
Vasectomy Reversals by Dr. Wu. All insurance accepted. Call 24 hours a day. Toll-free number. That's where she's buried, Sebastian. Under that billboard, right next to a cornfield. My father had a vasectomy 2 years before I was born. Not sure what went wrong, and my mother was certainly perplexed. Maybe she was seeing someone on the side. So who's my daddy, right? I guess we'll never know. Anyway, I've always had this fascination with vasectomies. A snip here and a snip there, drive yourself home and shoot blanks for the rest of your life. Such a simple procedure, but such dramatic results. You had the big V, Sebastian?
No.
Didn't think so. You're such a stud.
So you buried her. Is that what you're saying, Arch?
Ain't saying anything, Sebastian, except goodbye and thanks for keeping this a secret. I'll check in later.
Chapter 11. I wrap myself in a blanket and sit outside on the small terrace. It's cold and dark, and the streets far below are quiet and empty. In moments like these, I wonder why I became a criminal defense lawyer. Why have I chosen to spend my life trying to protect people who, for the most part, have done horrible things? I can justify it on the usual grounds, but at times like this, my heart is not really in it. I think about architecture school, my second choice. But then, I know some architects, and they have their own issues. First scenario. Swanger is telling the truth. In that case, am I bound by ethics and duty to stay quiet? Hand in hand is the question, am I really his lawyer? No and yes. We signed a contract, but he breached the contract by paying with a bad check. No contract means no representation.
but it's never that clear. I met with him on two occasions, and during both, he considered me to be his lawyer. Both were clearly lawyer-client meetings. He asked for advice, I gave it. He followed most of it. He confided in me. When he told me about the body, he certainly thought he was talking to his lawyer. Second scenario. Let's say I'm his lawyer. I never see him again, and I decide to tell the police what he told me. It would be a serious breach of client trust, probably enough to get me disbarred. But who will complain? If he's on the run or dead, how much trouble can he cause me? Third scenario. Plenty. If the body is where he says it is, and I tell the police, then Swanger will be hunted, found, tried, convicted, and given death. He would blame me, and he would be correct. My career would be over. Fourth scenario. I cannot tell the police under any circumstances. They don't know what I know, and I'm not about to tell them. I think about the Kemp family and their nightmare, but there's no way I can break a confidential relationship. With luck, the family will never know that I know. Fifth scenario. Swanger is lying. He seemed too anxious to tell me. He's playing games and sucking me into some awful scheme that will only end badly. He knew the check would bounce. His poor mother has never seen $5,000 in her life. Nor has he. Sixth scenario. Swanger is not lying. I can leak the information to Nate Spurio,